Welcome to Create Photography, this is Daniel Sig. In today's episode, I will have a conversation with UK-based artist Linda Bembridge. Linda is a fine art photographer based in the UK. Linda has been awarded a fellowship of the Royal Photographic Society, as well as an award for excellence of the International Federation of Photographic Art. Linda, welcome to Create Photography. I look very much forward to speaking with you today and learning more about you and your art.
Yeah, thank you. No, I'm very much looking forward to it.
Linda, you state on your website that your approach to photography continues to evolve as you learn more about what inspires you. And you mention you use a combination of in-camera techniques, color shifts, and yeah. You also mentioned you don't limit yourself to a subject or a place. So, or even, you know, other restrictions of processing techniques and so forth. So with this little preamble, I was just going to ask you, what have you learned? What inspires you, and what inspires you perhaps these days?
Great question. I think right now, over the last sort of few years, my work has become increasingly abstract, as you'll see if you look through my website. It's become increasingly abstract, probably increasingly colourful as well. And as I learn more about sort of working in the abstract world, it's made me realise how much there is to abstract photography. I think when I first sort of started abstracting more, I sort of thought, oh, you know, sort of abstract photography, how hard can it be? But actually, you know, there's abstract and there's abstract. And I think the more you get into it, the more you realize actually that the principles of composition that you sort of, you know, that should really apply to it in any sort of photographic space or any sort of art space are probably more important when you're working with abstract images, because they really are the things that hang the image together. You don't really have any core sort of subject matter, so really it's sort of it's the balance, the symmetry, the you know, making sure that if you've got space, it's there for a reason. And equally, if you know, if there's color, it's there for a reason. So it's very much that sort of evolution that interests me. And I try and abstract as much as I can when I'm out in the field as well, when I'm actually at the taking stage, because I find that if I abstract whilst I'm out at the taking stage, it gives me a much better idea as to whether I can work with those images in sort of post-processing. Whereas if I'm looking at something that's a bit more representational, I find it quite hard then to sort of look at the possibilities, and I find it hard to get excited from an abstract perspective. So I spend quite a lot of time working out in the field, making sure that what I come back with in camera is as abstract as I can make it. And that then gives me sort of a platform to move forward in the post-processing stage.
And so you mentioned in the field. So are you often just out in the city or nature, or are you, where
both.
Are you?
Both, very, very much so. And often using that, you know, using maybe a combination of sources. So I mean, recently I was in France last week, visiting some of the lovely chateaux and things like that. And it was actually really great fun to combine some photographs of some of the architecture and some of the sort of installations as well within the chateau, and then maybe combine those with, you know, images of poppies or things like that to try and see. I mean, whether they work or not, it doesn't really matter at the time.
The
main point is to actually play. So it's very much a combination of the two. I love photographing windows and doors and things like that. For me, not only are they interesting, but they're an interesting metaphor as well, in terms of looking through, looking out, looking into a different world. But I then often try and combine them as well with maybe images that are taken in the more natural environment, to try and maybe tell a different story. So it's very much looking for line, shape, color, you know, distress and texture as well, in whatever scene is in front of me. And it doesn't really matter whether that's urban or whether it's out in the trees, or whether it's at home sometimes. You know, sometimes, you know, you can find what you're looking for at home. We don't have to go very far.
You don't have
sometimes.
To go that far.
Exactly. So sometimes it's just getting that, you know, that mindset to think, right, I'm determined to find something at home and not stop until you do. So that can focus the mind. So yeah, it's anywhere really. It's anywhere.
Oh, that's great. And so actually what you just mentioned kind of leads nicely into my next question, where you mentioned on your website as well, you're drawn to shapes, colors, and a color and rhythm. And so I'm particularly interested. I can see the shapes and color clearly. Rhythm is, I found, interesting as well. Could you perhaps elaborate on this a little bit more?
Yeah, I think the rhythm really comes from my sort of 100% rule of working always in projects. I find a single image quite dissatisfying, and I think that's where the rhythm part comes in. Because I find a single image sometimes needs friends, in the way that we all found sort of during the COVID thing. You know, photographs, I think, are social beings in the same way that we are. And I think if you create, one of the things that I enjoy doing when I'm working in projects is actually taking a single image as an origin for a project. And actually just, you know, I do a lot of post-processing, a lot of messing about in Photoshop. You know, I mean, it is post-processing, but it's also messing about and playing. You know, you can call it something fancy if you like, but it's also just messing around. And I find if I work, one of the things I do often is work with a single image and just play with it until I end up with a series of results from that, which I can then put together into a panel. And I then find if I'm working on that basis, I've got commonality between the individual images in the panel, and the panel itself then starts to tell, you know, it starts to tell a story. And that's where, for me, the rhythm starts to appear. And it's very difficult to describe, but it's very easy to see when something doesn't have rhythm. I think it's very much something that, if it doesn't jar, then you can get the sense of movement through the body of work. But if something doesn't feel right, then that's where the rhythm is lacking. And that's what I spend quite a lot. I probably spend as much time putting a panel together than I do creating the source images for the panel. It can take me that amount of time, but it's probably the most satisfying part of, but maybe not quite the most satisfying part, but certainly in terms of the digital photographic stage, it's probably the most satisfying part of what I do. And that's where I think the rhythm comes through, not, as the case may be.
That's a great explanation and very interesting. So when you develop these panels, or are you, is that something... I just assume right now, I have reviewed your work on your website. Do you have a certain number of images in mind? I mean, is it you know, like 4 or 6, or is it really doesn't matter necessarily? And so that's maybe the first question and the kind of follow-up question to that. Are you printing your work as well at that stage, perhaps, or is that something more?
Yeah, very much.
Yeah. Okay.
No, absolutely. So in terms of the number of images in a panel, I tend to find that a sort of a 3x3 panel of 9 images is probably the smallest panel that I will work with. So if I start to, as I'm working through sort of post-process, if I start to get excited about what I'm doing and I start to play and things start to happen, then probably 9 is the smallest. But 12, a lot of my panels are 12. The most recent one that I've worked with and sort of published panel is 16. It was a 4x4 panel. Mm-hmm. And it really was just because I was just having fun. Things were working and I was having lots of ideas and it was just happening. So, but equally, in order to produce a sort of a panel of 16, I probably had about 23, 24 images that I worked with, because not everything will fit into the panel. Some things will jar, and some things won't work. So it's having enough to discard as well, and that's quite important. But then coming on to your second question, in terms of printing, I very much see the digital file as the start of another creative process. And that's something I spend an enormous amount of time working on. So I don't just print. It's up to me. I'm a great believer in the fact that there are huge amounts of advantages in being a digital worker. I can press the button on my printer, I can send something to print, and I can print 1,000 identical copies of it should I choose. And they're all going to be the same. They're all going to be, the colors are going to be the same, unless I run out of inks, obviously, but they're all going to be identical. And that for me is great, but it also is a big drawback, I think, because I quite like producing things that are unique, that are one-offs. So being a digital worker, that then says to me, okay, I need to print and then take that print somewhere that makes it unique. So that's where I start to either embellish a print, hand finish with gold leaf or platinum leaf or acrylics and oils and things like that. Or what I'm currently doing for an exhibition that I have coming up in July is printing on, effectively sort of three prints that almost have a three-dimensional effect by splitting the file into multiple layers and printing each of those layers onto clear film, embellishing them individually, the individual layers, and then sort of sandwiching them together but slightly separated, so that you can effectively see through into the print, and the print itself will be maybe sort of 1/4 inch, maybe 3/8 inch thick, with the different layers, and then either beading or painting or something on each of the layers to make them stand out. And that takes ages to do, but it's something that, you know, you sort of get into the flow state. It's something that I can just listen, you know, I can put some music on or listen to a podcast and spend hours working on these layers of clear film and then it's all backed, because obviously with clear film you can see straight through it. I back it all with a layer of white gold, so that when the light reflects onto the print, it's reflecting back white gold layer in the background, so that effectively the print itself has a sort of a luminosity that when you see it in the flesh, it's sort of lit from within. So that's what I spend a lot of time, and I've got an exhibition coming up where I'll be presenting about 20, 25, depending on how much I get done in the next month, about 20, somewhere between 20 or 25 of these layered prints, which are unique. I can't repeat them. So that for me is the joy of taking a digital process, something that's infinitely repeatable, and taking it somewhere that's not easily repeatable. And that for me is the joy of printing. You know, I think printing is, I think we should all print our work. And for me, a digital file, whilst it's great, that's just a gateway onto another process. And that's where the fun starts.
That's great. Yeah, it sounds super interesting. I would love to see what you just described in person. It's obviously not probably easy to show.
They're impossible to photograph.
I can imagine.
I have got some examples of them on my blog. I do a regular sort of monthly blog, but accompanying pretty much every little section that I have on there, where I show, I'm sort of showing what I'm doing and what I've been up to for the last month, sort of accompanying every little section of that is a little apology saying these are really hard to photograph because not only have you got the depth, which is very difficult to capture, obviously, in a photograph, you're also working with a very, very reflective surface, not only with the gold backing, but also working with clear film, which is like working with the glossiest surface you can ever imagine. So actually trying to get an angle where you haven't got either some sort of light reflection or some reflection of something that's on your wall that you haven't noticed or whatever. It's impossible. Mm-hmm. But anyway, you can only do your best with that. So,
right.
Yeah, quite hard.
So we talked about kind of some of your creative process, and I was really curious about some of the techniques. So you mentioned, you know, we talked about you go in the field and, you know, what some of the things are that inspire you. You talked a little bit about, you know, you're using Photoshop quite a bit, and you talked a little bit about other techniques. So I'm really curious if you can maybe discuss a little bit further.
Okay. Yeah.
Kind of that, these other techniques, because I find that just super fascinating. And also looking at your work, you know, it looks so painterly that, you know, if you would have told me, you know, these are photographs, I would have said, well, I'm not sure.
Okay. that's great.
Which is great, I think. But
That's a big tick in the box. Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. When I'm out in the field, I don't have a lot of kit that I carry around with me. I find I just have one camera, one lens. I find that if I have lots of kit, I tend to get it out of my bag less often because of of lugging a big bag around. So firstly, one of the main things that I've done is just limited to one camera, one lens, and that's that. And if I can't take what I want to take with that one camera, one lens, then I don't take it. And that's what I accept. But when I am out, as I say, the key thing for me is to try and abstract what I'm looking at as early as I can. And in order to do that, I use the multiple exposure function within my camera with its blending modes. I mean, these cameras that we have now, I mean, I use Nikon cameras, or always have done. No particular reason, just happened to have landed on Nikon early on. Yep. And you know, they are phenomenal computers if we allow them to do that. I know there's sort of there's a lot of people that will leave things on manual, they have super control over everything, and that's absolutely fine. I tend to go the other way a little bit, and let the camera let the camera software do a lot of things for me. So I'll use the blending modes, either the light or dark modes, in the multiple exposure. And I'll also mess about with white balance. The white balance that I pretty much never use is auto or sunny. I will always have the white balance on, I mean, my default tends to have, I tend to sort of leave it. If I have to have a default at all, it will tend to be on incandescent or tungsten or something that's quite a blue, that's quite a cool Kelvin. And I tend to mix that whilst I'm out in the field, sort of mixing cool Kelvins, you know, sort of blue tones with warm, which will either be, you know, sort of cloudy or shade, or even having a custom Kelvin that's, you know, way up in the oranges. And just try and see what happens, because sometimes on when you use a different blending mode, you can get some quite muddy colors, some greens and browns, which are quite difficult to work with. But if you have other combinations, it can, you can sometimes get start getting colors popping in your camera that are never there. They're not in the subject that you're taking. But when you start to use the blending modes in the camera and changing the white balance between exposures within a stack within the camera, you can start to get the camera popping all sorts of colors that are not in the scene that you're looking at. It's just the way that the software mixes things together in camera, which can then start to, you know, can start to spark the imagination. Because if you're looking at a wall that's fairly bland, maybe it's a window or something that I'm taking, it's a fairly normal wall, you know, maybe a dirty sort of beige color, and you're mixing the white balances and you start to get pinks and yellows and pale blues and things like that, you can start to think, you know, this is fun. And just letting the camera do its thing and start to get blocks of color and blocks of and shapes that are not in the source. And then that gives you something that you can play with when you get back. So that's what I try and do when I'm out. And also by saving an exposure down onto the memory card, and then maybe you're at a different location later in the day or something like that, going and picking up that file from the card and adding further things onto it later, which, you know, is standard functionality for a camera that does multiple exposure, which most of them do now. So, you know, it's again just layering it on. And I mean, the thing is, when you're doing that type of photography, you do end up with a lot of images. You do end up sort of, you know, there's no point in going out and taking 10 images and waiting for that decisive moment. You have to be prepared to take lots of images, have a decent sized card, and then to delete loads of them when you get back. But that's all part of the fun, because you never quite know what you're going to get until you look at it on the computer. I mean, one thing I do on my blog, when I do, there's a few, if you sort of go back, what I have done is included, when I have sort of some of the final panels, I've included the original raw file in the blog. I haven't necessarily included the techniques of how I got from one to the other, because most of the time I don't save those techniques. One thing I don't want is formulae that I'm tempted to repeat. So I don't save or remember the techniques that I use. But what I have done is included the original file as it comes out of the camera, so that you can see what the starting point was. And in most cases, that is an abstract image taken from something that has been out in the field, but it's abstracted enough for me to then start thinking, okay, I can take this further and mess around with it in post-processing. So I think, you know, that's one of the things that I've learnt in terms of the way that I work, is that if I'm not starting off with something that's abstracted, I find it difficult to take it forward. So using the multiple exposure functions in camera whilst I'm out and about, then sort of gives me that starting point. And without that, I find it hard to take something forward.
That's interesting. And so when you do your multiple exposures, do you still have the ability to to splice those out or to kind
You
of split
can,
them,
yeah, you
or
can. Yeah,
okay.
you can if you choose to. Certainly on the Nikons, and I know on the Canons. I'm not sure about the Fujis or Sonys, but on the Nikons and the Canons, you have the option to save each of the individual files. So if you've got a
Okay,
stack
so
of four or
got it.
five, you can save each of the four or five individual files as well as the multiple exposure. I tend to turn that off unless I'm in a particular scene. I mean, I was recently, as I say, I was in France and I was taking lots of photographs of poppies. And what I was doing in terms of multiple exposure whilst I was out, I just wasn't sure that it was really working. So I turned on the sort of save individual files because I thought actually it's quite nice to get lots of images of poppies that I can then play with afterwards. But so you can turn it on or off. The only thing about having it on is you do tend to hammer through your memory cards. So you do have to be aware that you're saving five or six files, large files rather than one. But it can be quite useful to have as a backstop occasionally. And then, whilst I was out in the field, I had an idea. I started working that idea, and I could see on the back of the camera that I was getting excited. So I turned off the sort of save individual files because I thought, actually, I'm not going to go back to those individual files because what I'm doing now, I'm quite excited about. So I'm going to pursue this path rather than. And so, it's a question of knowing that those functions are there and using them as and when you're maybe not sure that what you're doing from a multiple exposure perspective is working. So you have it as a bit of an insurance policy to make sure you don't waste a location completely. But then if something does start to work, I was there at these poppies for probably about 2 hours before I started to hit on an idea that I thought was worth pursuing. So it's not, as with everything, you have to just sit there and work it, just sat on my bag and, at the side of a field and just tried, a million things before something started to work and an idea started to sort of percolate. And then I started to get excited about what I was doing. And that's when I turned off the sort of save the images and went back and deleted a lot of them because I needed the space on the card. So,
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And so let's assume, so you have your in-camera work, you're pretty happy, you take it back home, you're looking at it, you're selecting, you might be deleting, as you mentioned. Can you take us now further through your process and how where you take it from there, perhaps?
I try not to look at the images that I've taken. So if I've just been out, I've just, as I say, I've just come back from France. So I've got quite a few images that I took whilst I was there, made the most of the trip. I tend not to look too much through them for a while. I did get excited about the poppies, so I have put those on my blog, but I haven't looked through much of the other of what I'm doing, much of the rest of them, because I tend to find that it's useful to have a bit of space between the time that you took the image and the time that you're starting to look for something to work on, because I find that the images themselves, if I look at them too soon, I have a memory of what I was trying to do. And often, you look at it and you think, well, that didn't quite work, or, I thought that would come out better than it did, or I didn't see that whilst I was there. What's going on there? So I tried to create a little bit of space initially. But then what I'll do, I'll just often sort of carve out a few days sometimes and just say, do you know what to, for these few days, I'm going to work on, and produce some images because it's too easy to get sucked into, doing printing all the time or doing some other sort of, photography admin that we all seem to get sucked into. And then say, do you know what? I'm going to look for something. I'm going to go through and I want to create a body of work and I want to start creating a new set of a new panel. So I'll just start to just flick through, get an idea of what I'm working for, look for some shapes and some lines and some colors. What am I feeling as well? Am I feeling you know, where is my head? Am I happy about what I'm doing at the moment? Am I feeling a bit stressed, a bit trapped? Am I, you know, what do I want to convey? And start to look for things that start to support that feeling. One of the panels that I produced a few months ago was called Effervescence, which is joy, it's fun, it's sort of got life to it. And I had some images that I took in and around some puddles of just some sparks, you know, some specks of sunlight catching the water, catching the reflections, just in and around some reeds and things like that. So I thought, actually, joy, splashing, messing around in the water, I can start to pull together. And also fizz, you know, if you think about effervescence of sort of carbonation and things like that. And I thought, I can actually use the water to start creating a story around that. So it's very much, and that then starts to hang together the idea for a body of work. So it's very much something that I will look for words around a project at the same time that I work on a project. And often the two will evolve at the same time. I've just produced a book that sort of goes through a lot of that and actually writes a lot of the words associated with a panel of work, and that can influence a lot. It can be a very, very strong influence into the way that I process the images themselves. Because if you want to produce a body of work that is fun, that is playful, then you produce them very differently to if we were in the depths of lockdown and you can't go out and you're feeling a bit fed up and you're depressed and you want to go out for a drink with your friends, you know. So it's that sort of thing. So I think that I'll try and sort of tune in and think, well, why do I feel the urge to produce a body of work now? What's going on? And so the actual taking of the images is quite divorced from how I feel when I get to processing them, because when I start to process an image, it will be because I feel that sort of that need to say something, that need to communicate. And words and titles, words around a panel of work and titles for images for me are just as important as the images themselves. And without that, the images for me don't really have context. My most recent body of work is called Believe, because I think that I did a course sort of earlier this year on Stoic philosophy, and
it's funny, like I'm just rereading some of that. I've been into it way pretty deep several years ago, and now I just recorded an episode on Stoic philosophy and how it may apply to photography. I haven't released it yet, but it's so funny you mentioned that.
It's fascinating for me. I think it's got an enormous applicability to photography. One of the things that I picked up on that really resonated with me was having a word for the year, which is like your pole star, your guiding light for the year, which you then use to frame everything that you do within that context. And my sort of word for 2022 is believe. And so I then started to pull together a body of work for that with lots of words surrounding that. And that for me was a really strong driver behind, you know, that philosophy and that methodology of how to sort of use that and actually have belief in what you do and let it underpin what you do and maybe take some risks in the hope that sort of, you know, if you leap, the net will find you, that sort of thing. And actually just allow yourself to just take a few risks in the knowledge, you know, that what's the worst that could happen? And that sort of driven me down a path. You know, as I say, I've just self-published a book and I've called it Believe. That's, you know, in terms of within that whole context of actually saying, do you know what? I have confidence in my work. I have confidence in the fact that, you know, I do believe that what I'm doing is the right thing for me at this right time. I have, you know, I have that faith, and that for me has been a really sort of strong driver, certainly behind what I've done photographically this year. Mm-hmm. I don't know what next year's word will be, but it doesn't matter. I'll need to worry about that when I get to it. But that whole sort of, you know, not overthinking, just you know, one step at a time, thinking carefully, taking lots of breaks, and coming back fresh, and not getting not overthinking, just focusing on what I enjoy. And that's really sort of informed a lot of what I've done this year. You know, the printing on the acetate, the clear film, took me a long time to get that to a point where I was happy with what I was doing. It was a lot of, you know, someone said to me, you know, how would you get started with sort of printing on clear film? And my answer is, make sure that you've got a very large bin, because you know, it's a massive learning curve. But I just thought, you know what, I will work this out because I know it's the right thing. Mm-hmm. And I just plowed on with it. And then eventually things started to happen. Things started to work. And, and I'm really happy with what I'm doing and just sort of sticking with it. And that sort of stoicism of, you know, just persevering, just do the work.
Just do the work.
And
don't worry. Well, I mean, at some point, right, you may worry about the end product, but it's really the journey and the work.
Yeah, it's all about the journey. And I was having fun while I was doing it. So that was ticking that big box.
That's great. Yeah. Well, and it's interesting, a great segue. That was actually one of my next questions, is your self-published book. And you mentioned on your website that this book charts a journey of 2 years it took you to find, you mentioned, balance in your life. And you said you left a career in the finance industry and transitioned now into a world of creativity. It's very interesting. I interviewed now a few photographers, artists thus far, but nobody from finance yet. With that background, which is pretty interesting. But I'd love to learn a little bit more, if you don't mind, about, you know, your transition, because I think that sounds fascinating.
Happy to sort of talk about that. The sorry, I'm just turning my phone off. I just bleeped there. So I worked in finance for my entire sort of working career, as an accountant by profession, but not necessarily working as an accountant per se. I worked for a software company that designed financial software for insurance companies and banks. And I did a lot of the design work and plowed through regulations and things like that. So I worked very much on that side of the business. And it was hard work. It was a very small company. And we rode a few sort of regulatory waves, which ended up being much larger than we had anticipated. And as with so many of these things that sort of hit you, we were understaffed and all of that stuff, and we couldn't get people trained up quickly enough and whatever. Anyway, I ended up being sort of caught up in a few years of these waves where I pretty much worked 24/7 for probably about 4 or 5 years. And I mean, I'll be honest, it was a career that I really enjoyed. I mean, it wasn't, you know, it wasn't a drudge. I mean, it was hard work, but it wasn't a drudge at all. I got a lot out of it. And because of the work that I did with it, you know, everyone thinks, well, finance, you know, can be a bit boring. Actually, it can also be quite creative. A completely different way. But it can also be quite creative. I'd taken photographs for a few years before, you know, I really had to sort of immerse myself in my career completely. I couldn't do the two, but I'd always had not always had a camera, but for certainly 4 or 5 years before it got completely chaotic, I had had a camera, but I hadn't worked in, I had simplified a lot of my images, but not necessarily abstracted them. Although if I look through the latter end of that sort of phase. My work was becoming more abstract, but not completely abstract. But then I sort of had to immerse my, I had to make a decision. I couldn't do the two. I couldn't keep photography going and do the work, basically the paid work. I couldn't keep the two going, so the photography just had to take a back seat for a few years. I knew that it had a time limit on the work side, so I just had to immerse myself in it. And to be honest, you know, I'd not long got divorced, and you know, mm-hmm. which is not cheap. So I just thought I had to immerse myself into the finance side of it and the work side of it, and just hunker down for a few years, get through the work that we had to do, and then sort of emerge and see where I was at the end of that. And actually, I'm glad I did that. But it then did take me, once I could see that we were coming to the end of a wave, it took me a few years to break away from it and to actually make a decision that was enough. Mm-hmm. I couldn't do any more from a health perspective. I knew that if I carried on, it would start negatively affecting my health. The levels of stress, the constant travel, the lack of sleep, the lack of any meaningful break. I once made a New Year's resolution that I wouldn't work before 6 a.m. or after 11 p.m. And I remember telling my mum that was a New Year, and she looked at me as if I'd gone mad, but it was only when I said it out loud that I thought, actually, goodness me, that's probably a bit crazy. But at the time it sounded, it felt like a good New Year's resolution, which is how I'd lost perspective on everything. Everything had just mm-hmm. become so distorted. So I spent, once I made the decision that enough was enough, it then took me 2 years to break away, not just because of the difficulties of leaving a company, but also, you know, working like that and being involved in those sort of initiatives is quite addictive. Mm-hmm. I actually found it hard to let go, mm-hmm. and I ended up having, you know, to have the help of a coach to try and help me break away from it. And then when I eventually did break away and did stop, we had just a few weeks, and then we were into all the lockdowns for the pandemic, which I know it was grim and horrible, but I think at the time for me it was probably a good thing, mm-hmm. because it did force me to rest. I couldn't carry on at a million miles an hour. I had to stay at home. I had to rest. Because there was, you know, we couldn't do anything else. And that was when I really started to focus on my photography a lot more, and decide to sort of try and live a creative life, as I, you know, started to call it. Mm-hmm. And that was when I started my blog, because mainly to keep myself accountable, because I thought, well, if I do a monthly blog and I've got nothing to write about in that month, what have I been doing? So that was really the sort of challenge for me, was to keep myself accountable, in that if I haven't got anything to write about, then, you know, get your act together, get moving, and make sure mm-hmm. you have got something to write about. And that's been a very good way to make sure that I keep momentum, that I keep trying new things, and that I keep experimenting, so that I've got something to write about as well. Mm-hmm. I certainly don't regret those years in finance, but I certainly am glad that I'm not involved in that world now. It was brutal, and it was certainly starting to affect my health. Mm-hmm. And we all have to, you know, that's the one thing. That doesn't matter what else you've got, but if you haven't got your health, then what else you've got is largely meaningless.
Yeah, then it's exactly.
So it was good fun, and I saw a lot of the world, but I'm glad not to be doing it now.
Yeah, and now you can focus on your art. And
So
can you tell me a little bit more about the book? So you told me already a little bit about Believe as your yearly word.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it sort of charts.
I'd love to learn more about the book.
Yeah,
as well.
It sort of charts. There's sort of two aspects to it. It charts the 2 years since I left, since I left my career. So it sort of charts those 2 years. And yes, it was through COVID and all that stuff, but it doesn't focus on that at all. It really sort of takes those 2 years and almost sort of it takes each of the, because all of the projects that I've worked on are all sort of connected, even though they're independent projects. And as I say, each of the projects has words associated with them. So there's a project statement for all of them, and each of the images has titles and whatever. But I'm also sort of pairing that with where I was in that sort of 2 year period, where my head was, what the thinking was behind why these images resonated with me at the time, and how they sort of fit into the overall picture. I'm a very big fan of a photographer called Paul Kenny, and I heard him speak a short while ago, and he says his view on charting our journey is that your journey as a sort of photographer or artist or wherever you are is it can be viewed as a rope. And over the years, this rope has threads to it that can run right from the start right through to now. And you might add some threads, you might drop some threads, but there's a core that runs through everything that you do. And for me, that's quite interesting. It was a really interesting concept. And for me, that's been quite interesting to try and explore. So to try and trace those threads through the projects, through that period of time, to find those connections, to find that commonality, and to try and understand how things all fit in to each other. It was only by actually sitting down and looking at the project and looking at the sequence that I'd produced them in, and then sort of thinking, okay, well, what was going on? Why did that project follow the previous one? What was I thinking? Mm-hmm. Where was my head? Hmm. Why did those images resonate at that time? So it's sort of like it takes those projects and doesn't just talk about the writing of the individual projects itself, but I then sort of put it into context in terms of some sort of a timeline of how I was feeling, how it sort of builds onto the overall picture and things like that. So I don't talk about techniques or anything at all. That's not the driver behind what I do. I've had a few questions on that, and I don't talk about technique. I could never tell anyone what techniques I use because, as I say, I don't save them. I don't remember them, consciously don't remember them, because I don't want to. I call it the rut of repeatability. I don't want to be able to repeat anything in terms of what I do. That for me feels very lazy. So it's very much about what I was thinking, what images mean to me, and what the projects meant to me at the time. And I'm quite, you know, in terms of a sort of a reflection on the period since I left work. I mean, I think, you know, I was burned out when I left work. I was completely burned out and probably quite broken as a human being, just through sheer exhaustion. And I think, you know, it has taken me time to get that pressure and get that behind me. And I think it's very easy to think, you know, after a few months, you know, everything's fine. And then you sort of, you know, you go through that process of not being defined by your work anymore. And that again comes back to the stoic aspect of not allowing something that's external to define you, because when you lose that, then have you lost your definition? Have you lost your raison d'etre? So it's very much, it was part of the reason why I did look into, you know, and start to pick up some of the stoic principles, because actually I was tied into, you know, my definition, my work title, you know, and all of that, and the fact that I did have, you know, a pretty big job, and that's actually sort of getting away from that and tearing yourself away from that, and actually for that not to be a thing anymore. And so it's sort of charting a lot of that. And it doesn't, you know, it's not too, you know, introverted in that sense. There's not, you know, huge amounts of words, but there's enough words to, you know, to give everything context. Mm-hmm. And I've been quite open and honest. I mean, a friend of mine who proofread it for me obviously came back with a few things, but also with a sort of final statement that just said it's a bit personal. And I thought actually that's actually a good thing. I was quite pleased with that, you know, almost as if it's a bit sort of but you know, that for me ticked a box. That was what I wanted.
Right. So it was an expression of your journey in that sense, right? But then also, I mean, obviously an expression of your art as well, right?
Very much so. I mean, it's predominantly images, but it's also putting the images, enough words to put the images in context. And that was important.
Yeah. Oh, that's great. Thanks for sharing that. And so you mentioned some of your influences. And I know there's some others as well, other photographers. I'm actually curious, are there any non-photographer artist influences as well? Maybe abstract painters or other artists?
Very much so. I mean, predominantly artists, you know, predominantly painters, to be honest.
Okay.
I mean, there's a few on Instagram that I follow. You know, Kate Trefelli is a fantastic artist in her use of color. But then I go back, you know, I mean, I keep coming back to Kandinsky and and Klimt and his use of gold on in his art, and some of the shapes and colors, and Miro, and I also look at a lot of the Bauhaus influences. It's something that I've explored recently through some publications that I've come across. So some of the Bauhaus influences, and you know, I mean, Jackson Pollock is a big influence as well. I did a course last summer, and one of the challenges on the course was to produce some work in the style of an artist that you admired. And I thought, okay, Jackson Pollock, you know, how hard can it be? And I thought, right, so I'm going to produce some work in the style of Jackson. You know, it's almost like today I'm going to be Jackson Pollock. And I started to mess around with, and actually it was really, really hard. And actually, actually that's one of the ways that I do actually try and sort of almost pay homage to some of these artists, but also it makes you understand a lot more about the way that they have approached their images if you're trying to sort of emulate them. And obviously they don't see the light of day, but it's a great way of learning their approach to and why their images work. You know, they work for a reason, but sometimes it's not immediately obvious what the what the principles are and how, you know, so almost like studying their work rather than just admiring it. So actually, you know, most of my, well, you know, if I look at my, I mean, I'm terrible with social media. I have splurges. I'm on there sort of, you know, almost constantly for a week, and then I don't go there on there for 3 months, you know, but most of the people that I follow on Instagram are painters, either watercolor, oils, you know, acrylics, whatever. Very few of them are actually, most of the photographers that I follow on there are friends. The actual, you know, the key people that I follow that aren't friends, most of them are painters, abstract artists.
Yep. Oh, that's great.
Very much so.
I want to talk a little bit about the genre of fine art photography, and I don't want us to get too hung up on the semantics, but it's more maybe but let me maybe define it in a way that to say that maybe fine art photography distinguishes itself from, let's say, documentary photography. It's probably removed from the literal a little bit, to some extent, right? But my question goes more into more practical aspects, maybe more the stoic aspects of that, and not so much really the term, because I don't even know if I like that term. But What advice would you give to some of us who maybe feel like, you know, been doing photography or art, you know, but I just want to get more into it. I want to maybe change something maybe do something different. And what advice would you give them if they want to kind of get maybe go into that?
Yeah, I think realm. For me, the biggest thing is to think about what gives you joy. What's fun to you? And not to get hung up on labels, not to get hung up with, you know, I mean, there's so much out there when you talk about photography. I've had some people come to me and say, well, that's not a photograph. You're not a photographer, because what you've done is you've taken things, you've messed about with things. It's not a photograph anymore. And I think, well, so what? It doesn't matter. Exactly. I'm not asking, you know, if you actually look at what I do, I don't call myself a photographer. I think it's very easy to get hung up on what other people are going to think about what you're doing. Whilst forgetting the fact that whatever you're doing, you picked up a camera, you picked up a paintbrush, you picked up whatever it was you picked up because you wanted to, and you were motivated to do it because you thought you might enjoy it. And I think it's really easy to get caught up in the words, in the language, in the titles, in putting yourself in a box, and not allowing yourself to come out of that box, because you don't want some negative feedback, or you don't want any sort of unwanted advice, let's put it that way. And I think tuning in to what you enjoy, what you can get lost in, is really important. And you know, if you're not sure about something, then try a course. There's loads of online courses and things like that out now. And if it doesn't resonate with you, then okay, you might cost you a little bit of money, but you've lost a bit of time, but you haven't lost much. And you'll always take something away from it, even if it's not quite what you expected. I think by exploring and playing, you might open up a whole world that you didn't know existed. Because as you start to look at something, as you start to play with, a year ago, if someone had said to me I was printing sort of three-dimensional acetate prints, I would have just stared at them. It's like, well, on what planet is that ever going to happen? But you try a few things and it takes you down a path, and then you might see something that sparks and percolates in the back of your mind and you start to develop it and think about it. But I think it's very easy to get caught up in language, as you said, and sort of what is fine art photography, documentary photography, street photography. Well, if I'm out taking images of architecture and things like that, is that street photography? Is that what is it? It doesn't matter what it is. It's really easy to get caught up in the labels. And it's also very easy for others to pass judgment on something if it doesn't fit into their box that they're working within. And it can sometimes be quite hard to build that resilience to think, well, actually, I'm doing what I want to do, and others may have a view on that, and that's fine, they're entitled to their view, but that doesn't necessarily have to influence me at all. I can choose to take what I want from it, and I can choose to ignore it, but it's my choice. And I think, you know, for me, having that freedom of just playing and tuning into what I'm having fun doing has been transformational in the work that I do, because if others like it, great, but if they don't, I'm having fun anyway. And I'm not going to stop doing what I'm doing just because someone else doesn't think it's photography. That's their view, not mine. So I think it's about tuning in and having fun and allowing yourself to play, the freedom to play, and the freedom to fail as well. Because, you know, if you look at Rothko, if you look at some of his sort of earlier work, you'd never think that his sort of big, bold, colourful blocks of work, you'd never think that that's where he would end up. Because if you look through his sort of early works, you would never you'd never get to where he got to. Mm-hmm. There is, I mean, there's a path there, but he started out somewhere very, very different. Mm-hmm. And that's why I think as well, it's important when you are looking at an artist or you're looking at other photographers to look at the journey.
Yep.
Because it can give you so much freedom, because you don't have to put yourself in a box. You can evolve, you can change. And that's all part of just allowing yourself the freedom to try new things and to let go of things in order to try new things.
So
it can easily, you know, I mean, I know with my sort of acetate prints, I have an exhibition coming up in July and August, and I've loved doing them, but I've got ideas on what next, and some of it doesn't involve acetate, you know, you just want to try new things, you know. It's again just moving on, and it may come back in a later date, but if it does, it'll come back in a different form.
Mm-hmm.
And that's fine.
That's great. And so you mentioned that's great perspective. I'm just curious. So you mentioned, you know, of course, there are a lot of online resources to learn new techniques or new things.
Yeah.
Did you have a mentor or somebody who helped you in your creative journey? Or was it just, you know, you just kind of learned things as you went? And
I wouldn't say I had a mentor, but okay. I have someone that I follow, Valda Bailey, and Valda's very creative in what she does with her prints and with her work. And you know, there's been I've done a couple of courses in terms of hand finishing work, which has set me off on a path. But also I was just actually, whilst I was waiting to start this conversation, just researching some hand finishing painting, hand finishing printing courses, and looking at there's an awful lot of stuff on YouTube that you can take snippets from as well. But, you know, I quite like doing a hands-on as in necessarily being present in a studio, but you can do quite a lot of, you know, online courses. And sometimes, you know, doing something that's a bit left field can be quite interesting. You know, I did an acrylic painting course, which I'm really not good at starting a blank piece of paper. I can start with a photograph and take it forward, but it gave me quite a lot of ideas as to how to apply that to my photography. So sometimes doing something that, you know, in and of itself isn't necessarily gonna, you know, I never produced an acrylic painting at the end of it, but I came away with lots of ideas as to how to apply that to my photography. It's sometimes just sort of, you know, just going with something and accepting the fact that, you know, you're not going to produce a masterpiece in that particular skill, but it might just spark ideas as to how you can take it forward in a different space.
That's great idea. Yeah, sometimes right, going out of that box, so to say, it can be very creative or inspirational, I guess. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Even if it just teaches you how to use the materials, that's often half the battle. You know, you can end up being quite a significant accelerator if you learn how to use the materials. Then you can take it, you know, you don't have to go through that whole learning process and making mistakes that thousands of other people, you know, you don't need to reinvent the wheel. You can learn from others and just say, well, okay, this is how I prepare a canvas. So do I need to apply that to preparing a, you know, if I've printed something and I want to paint onto it, do I have to do any prep for the paper in order for that ink not to, you know, curl the paper or whatever? You know, you can find those things out very easily by doing maybe a short course or something. You don't have you don't have to go through all of that pain. Others have gone through that pain. But then it's up to you to take it forward in a way that works for you, rather than, you know, sort of actually slavishly following what maybe the course has told you. You can just take elements and work with it yourself.
Yeah, that's great. Well, so before we wrap up, I would like us to go to one of your projects. We briefly touched on or you briefly touched on the importance of projects, and I personally totally agree with that. I think it's wonderful to work in projects and in series and so forth. So one that I want, that I kind of just picked out and I just want to kind of get your thoughts on, is called Windows from Walls.
Yeah.
And we'll link to that in the show notes as well. And just if you can tell me a little bit about it and
Windows from Walls.
Maybe the technique. We don't have to get hung up on the techniques, but I'm just curious a little bit, learning a little bit more.
No, absolutely. That was one of the first projects that I did meaningfully. It was a dirty old sort of wall. I was in Morocco when I took the source image, but it was a dirty old wall with a window, but it had lots of texture to it, and I had abstracted the wall itself using multiple exposure. But I'd only two or three images in the multiple exposure stack, but it was the one thing that I made a conscious effort to do with that particular series was to sort of work with color. Sometimes I feel that I can be a bit brash with color and a bit sort of overbearing with it. So it was trying to make sure that I retained some subtlety in terms of the color that I was using. And I'm not entirely sure that I achieved it, because I love working with color and bright colors. I think, it can be completely joyful in some instances. But it was the first time where I really sort of worked with a project that had a theme before I started. So the walls, the Windows with Walls has writing associated project statement, in a sense of, you know, the mystery of being able to look through a window to sort of mystery inside, but also to be able to look out through a window at the universe parading past. I think are some of the words that I've used, but it's also one of the first projects that I believe has true rhythm to it, in terms as you work through the project, because there are those repeating elements, because it works from the same source file. So it has those repeating elements. It has little areas of sort of honeycomb that were in was in the wall on one of the air vents, I think. But also some of the window furniture, the latches, the hooks, some of the things that were actually in the architecture itself are repeated as you go through the panels. So it hangs together as a series, as well as looking at the individual prints themselves, very colourful, very highly detailed in the sense of pulling out the textures and things like that. So very little sort of blank spaces, but also there are images that have solid blacks, solid whites, solid areas of highlights, which, you get, the traditional saying, well, there's no detail in the blacks, your highlights are blown. And it's like, yeah, I know, it's my print, it's my image. I know, you don't need to tell me. So it's the first, one of the first panels that I did, which really started to teach me a bit about the principles of working in the abstract world. The panel of work that I did prior to that, was quite disjointed, but it was a huge learning exercise for me in terms of how to start working in abstract panels and how to give them coherence, how to give them rhythm. And even if you are working with crazy colors, with the bright pinks, the bright cyans, the yellows, the golds, the reds, you can still make it work as a panel as long as you've got those repeating elements and as long as you've got a flow as you go through. That's a 3x4 panel, so there's 12 images in that. And how to put them together so that you can move seamlessly from one print to the next in the panel, whichever way you choose, up, down, across, diagonally. It works as a set, or I believe it works as a set. And it taught me a lot about composition, about repeating elements, about structure within an abstract image. And as I say, just because an image is abstract doesn't mean that it doesn't have to follow certain rules. It's abstract is not your get out of jail free card. Yeah. It still has to hang together. It has to work somehow. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I think that was the first body of work where I consciously came away and I thought, actually, I'm quite happy with that. Even if I can't quite explain why I was happy with it, I started to think with that panel, you could be onto something here. And I was just sort of working with earlier before we started the conversation, I was just working with, I've printed quite a lot of those in acetate and just sort of working with them and sort of looking at the colours and thinking, actually, they're a bit mad, but they're fun. they do look nice printed on the acetate because they're, the light shines.
Oh, sorry, I was just going to ask, how big are they when you print them, or in what size do you?
Yeah, the acetate themselves, I've printed them, the actual acetates within the print, they're in 50 centimeter square mounts, but the actual acetate itself is 30 centimeter square within that. So slightly bigger than 12 inches, because I think if they become, and actually they're quite heavily embellished within that, but I think if I get too much bigger than that, then it becomes hard to keep the acetate separate on the layers. So it's more sort of a physical issue. It's more of a sort of technical issue. The acetate starts to get a bit floppy. It's quite hard to keep it flat. But also I'm not overly a fan of huge, great prints. I think sometimes it's quite nice to look into something rather than stand back and look out. I think sometimes it's quite nice to have something that's not big just for the sake of being big. Sometimes I think you have to think about why, you know, just because you've got a printer that might be able to print 36 inches wide, which I don't have, 36 inches wide, doesn't mean that you have to do it. I think sometimes printing, you know, just thinking about the size and thinking that small can be good as well. It doesn't always have to be too large. They're all standard. They're all a standard size. They're all that size. I've kept it the same throughout all of the work that I've printed.
Okay. Mm. Yeah. Well, that's great. Yeah, thanks for sharing that. They look beautiful. So we'll link to in the show notes to this particular project as well. And then I guess to wrap up just quickly, where can people find you online?
I've got my website, which is lindabenbridge.com. I do a monthly blog, and I've been doing that for a couple of years now. So there's the blog archive on my website, which people can have a look through subscribe. If not, then all the history is there. I'm not great at sort of tagging and categorizing things. So you've almost just got to go back and have a look and see what each of the blogs say. I tend to blog about once a month, once every 5 weeks, something like that, just to keep some sort of regularity going. It's my website. I'm a bit sporadic on social media. I tend to think that there are better things to do with life, but I know that most people, that's the way to sort of market yourself and things like that. But I endless debates with my inner self about the
same the here. Time I, it I, takes. I'm not spending much time on it anymore, so I just decided that.
I think life is just too short. So, so I tend to stick to the blog. And people can always, if there are questions or anything, people will always get in touch. There's a contact page on there. And I'll always reply. It might take me a day or so, but I'll always reply. My blog is the main way of finding out what I'm up to. And I'm quite open. I share things, and I share my highs and lows, things that have worked, things that haven't worked. There have been projects that I've started and have not continued for various reasons. And I'm quite open about that. So it's not just, it's not just sort of, this is the wonderful thing I'm happy with today. Yeah. It's sort of, this is a project that I've started. Right. It's not quite working. I'm not quite sure why, but it's, abandoned and maybe start something new. So, you know, I'm quite open about things that have worked and things that haven't. I think you can't just share. You know, it's a journey for all of us. Yep. So yep. I'm quite open about that.
Wonderful. Well, great. Well, Linda, thank you so much for speaking with me today. It was really a pleasure. I loved learning more about you and your art. And
it's great.
Have a wonderful day.
Yeah, thank you for the opportunity. It's been great.
This wraps up our episode with UK-based artist Linda Bembridge. I highly recommend you check out her work at lindabembridge.com. I will also link to her website and the project we discussed in the show notes. Thanks so much for listening, and talk to you next time.